From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about going out for dinner in Utah maybe 10 years ago. There were good restaurants, of course, but your choices were pretty limited if you wanted quality food from chefs who were trying new things. But right around 2009 or so not that long ago, something started to change. And it's hard to say exactly what, but Utah's food culture began to awaken. Suddenly we had a scene with legit foodies and chefs and entrepreneurs. They were foraging for local food, they were experimenting with new ingredients, and more importantly, maybe people were showing up, paying good money for this good food. There's a new book just out that explores Utah's emerging food movement, and it's giving us a chance to talk about it. We hope you'll join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to pin this kind of thing down, but for the past 5-6 years, Utah, Salt Lake in particular, has been going through a kind of food revolution. If you like to go eat out, then you know what I'm talking about. Josh and Becky Rosenthal say Salt Lake has a bona fide real-life food scene these days, with bona fide foodies leading what they say is a charge for a renewed city, with chefs and entrepreneurs who are full of new ideas that are elevating the city and its culture. They've written a book that explores this emerging movement, which is giving us a chance to talk about Utah's food scene. Just what does a food scene say about a place, and what does it mean that Utah has one now? Or maybe Utah's always had one. Who led the way with this new one? Who's making it work, and where is it headed? Josh and Becky Rosenthal run the blogs SLC Foodie and Vintage Mixer. Josh is managing partner of Charming Beard Coffee. It's an artisan coffee roaster here in Salt Lake City. The book that I'm talking about is called Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes. I didn't mention the recipes part yet. Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. Josh and Becky Rosenthal, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for being with us. We also have Mary Brown Maloof with us, longtime food writer, editor of Salt Lake Magazine. Mary, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Nice
to be here.
Ted Scheffler is with us, food and wine reviewer for the Salt Lake City Weekly, which he's now been doing, 20 years?
20 years. Oh. 20 years.
He's also co-editor of the new local food magazine, Devour, and welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Josh and Becky, I want to start with you. So how did you get started with the project? What made you think, oh, let's try a book?
Actually, the publisher pursued us, and so it really started with our blog. I think that they probably found that we were interested in the food scene, writing and photographing food in Salt Lake City just from our online website.
Yeah, it was basically January 15th of last year we got a call.
Well, you turned it around in a year.
We turned it around in 90 days. Yeah. We had 90 days to take 200 photos, visit 60 restaurants, and get 80 recipes from those. So we didn't write the recipes, but we certainly had to stay on the chefs to give us those recipes. So we did one restaurant with a one-year-old, one restaurant every 36 hours for 90 days, and to turn it out. And it was, we turned it in even a couple days early just to make a statement that we're going to get it done. We're going to do a really good job, hopefully.
I think it was doable because we already knew the city and we knew the chefs and the restaurants beforehand.
But what did you want out of a book? I mean, what did you figure it would be? I mean, there are a lot of recipe books that, you know, have recipes from local restaurants. It's not entirely new in that way, but it seems like there's a different kind of spin you're putting on it.
Yeah, we wanted to communicate something new and different about the city that we love so much. We wanted to show people that there's really good food here. There's good culture. It's a place with a lot of freedom. People can take risks in their jobs and in their professions. And we were excited to be able to tell that through the food scene.
What does this question keeps coming back to me, and I want to get Ted and Mary, I want to get you involved in this too, but let me start with Josh and Becky. What does a food scene, what does a food scene say about a place? What does it tell you about a place?
That's a big question, but my initial thought on that is that on some levels, the food scene is a symptom of the culture. Is how I would see it. So to take a look and see what's happening in Utah, the whole story of what's happening in Utah isn't the food, but because of everything that is happening in Utah, food has a place. Yeah. So in order to spend what some of these restaurants charge for food, there's got to be good jobs, and there's got to be an economy that can sustain a night out for a couple that's $100 or $150 if you're going to eat well and drink well. So I think the food, in my opinion, says something about what's happening within our culture and economically.
Yeah, and people who are willing to try things like bone marrow and foie gras and stuff like that that maybe Salt Lake wasn't experiencing before.
But the Olive Garden always has packed parking lot, and so does Red Lobster. I mean, people were, you know, but this is different in some way. Why? Why do you figure that is? I mean, it's hard to define taste and say we're more sophisticated in our tastes, but it seems like we are. Mary's gesturing.
I think about this a lot.
Yeah.
is the thing, and I've written about food in a lot of other cities and cultures, and I do think that food is kind of more symptomatic. Not just symptomatic of a culture, but is the culture and shows where the culture is going. It's a thread of the culture. And in Salt Lake, I think that this place that it was founded in a kind of xenophobic idea, we're an island out here in the middle of the West. We're the only city for, well, you know how hard it is to get out of here to somewhere else. And we were founded for that isolation and for that geographic isolation, and for a long time it was a sort of mountain fastness in the West. You know, here we were without a lot of influences from outside, and frankly not wanting a lot. But leading up to the Olympics and after the Olympics, we became a more open culture, a little less xenophobic, and a little more proud of ourselves. I mean, it used to be, and I think it still is to a certain extent, the question of the chain restaurants. We're always so proud to get a chain restaurant because now we're just like everybody else.
Right.
You know, we're not the weirdos out in the West. You know, we are a real part of American culture. And the local food movement, which swept the whole nation when it rooted here, tied into an element of Utah culture that gave us pride in place. And pride in our past culture, pride in the pioneering and the gardening and the things that people do here that, you know, not everybody in Dallas or even in Sonoma or the Bay Area where I've written about food has a garden plot, keeps bees, keeps chickens. People did that here a long time before it became the cool thing to do and very Portlandia. We were Portlandia before Portlandia.
right. Ted, what do you think?
Well, to add a little bit to what Mary said, I think that, you know, I mean, our food culture here in Utah or in Salt Lake specifically, I think it's a microcosm of the larger culture, America and North America. And I think more than anything, what I've seen in the way of changes has been brought about largely by television. I hate to tell you that, Doug, but since we're on the radio.
Cool with it. It's okay.
But, you know, food television is pervasive. You know, every chef, it seems like, has his own show or her own show. And I just think that there's that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think, you know, a lot of us have been educated by food TV. And so, you know, 4 out of 5 Americans probably can make their own biscotti now and expect, you know, good fresh pasta at a restaurant instead of something out of a box. And so I think to the extent that food TV has helped to educate the American palate, that's taken a hold here just like everywhere else. And so we're a bit of a microcosm. You don't have to go to New York to get a piece of pork belly anymore.
Yeah.
No, that's true. I think that it's absolutely true. But the way that it's manifested in our specific microcosm is different from the way that food awareness, which has swept the nation. I mean, finally, Americans know how to eat and they know what foie gras and the difference between foie gras and pork belly is. And they're willing to try things like bone marrow and strange vegetables they've never heard of. But in this particular location, I think that the local aspect of that is what's really inspired a lot of people to open these small revolutionary restaurants. A restaurant like Forage is cutting edge. You could put it anywhere in the world and it'd still be cutting edge because they're just doing strange and interesting things with food, as anything you'll find in Chicago or New York or L.A.
To that point, because I think that's kind of what your book is going, is this idea that, yes, there are what Ted said is, I think, true. These are reflections of these bigger trends as well. But then how do they – what makes us different? I was actually going to come to this question later, but I'm going to get it out of the way. How is Utah's local food scene? Like, how are we different from Austin or Portland or Berkeley? You know, they have these local, you know, people wandering around in the foothills, wherever they might be, foraging for mushrooms or whatever. I mean, how are we different if we are?
I think we kind of knew this as we started the book, but then as we started to interview and to talk to chefs around the city, I think it was just more affirmed that we live in a place where it's really community-driven and there's not a lot of competition, although there's competition in a healthy sense. Chefs and restaurant owners are helping each other. One restaurant owner would point us to the next. They're, you know, sharing ideas and information about how to make their businesses more efficient. And so there really is a sense of community here, whereas in other places I feel like you're always trying to one-up the newest restaurant or come up with the best idea. And I think that spirit of community really helps a new restaurant owner to come in and feel like they can take a risk, they can try something new, and that the community of restaurants and the community of eaters would support that.
It's a hard question. It's probably one of my favorite questions to think about, is what makes us different, because I often lament on how sometimes Denver has the reputation that we deserve for being close to skiing and having an urban lifestyle. And so I just think, like, what is our thing? And I think, Becky, obviously, we've been married 10 years, so we're probably thinking fairly similarly about this, and that's that.
You guys use the word pioneering a couple of times.
Yeah, I think there's a pioneering aspect, and there's this oneness. And this oneness to me is what is most motivating. So for me, being in the coffee industry also, there's another coffee roaster in town, Public, or Blue Copper, and I am for their success because we, right now, because we're small, we need to, on some levels, band together in order to build a scene. So if there's not a lot of people that are going to spend that much more for coffee and wait that much longer for coffee. So we need to work together to build this scene up. So it's not very cutthroat, at least with what we've interacted with. So there's just a lot of oneness is probably the best way I can put it, that we are for each other's success. You hear these restaurateurs. So we talked to Matt Lake at Alamexo, and he was asking to make sure that we thought about a couple other restaurants that maybe weren't on our radar just because he was a big fan of them. So it's not cutthroat. And to me, that's really motivating.
I also think, Doug, that – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think that there's a healthy defiance that I feel here among chefs and restaurateurs and coffee makers and purveyors. And it's almost like, you know, a lot of them have moved here because they love the mountains. They love the lifestyle here. And, you know, by God, we're going to make it work no matter what. And maybe we don't have the most sophisticated palates to play with, you know, but we're going to do this and we're going to work together and we're going to elevate the culinary scene here. And I really, that's something I don't know, this may not be Portland or Berkeley or Austin, but you have these chefs that are really willing to fight the odds and sort of put their money where their mouths are.
And that way we talked about it being like the Wild West.
Well, I think that all of what you're talking about is a pioneering spirit. Pioneers need to band together. They need each other. Against everything out there. And that's very much the spirit here. I cut my teeth writing about the rise of Southwest cuisine in Texas, which until, you know, the Texas cuisine was a joke, like Utah cuisine was a joke. And then these chefs started combining local ingredients with, you know, chilies and all that stuff into fine cuisine. And they were a band of brothers, those guys and women, doing that in defiance of everything else. And they're very much a community spirit. It's not that way now. They're all after each other. And I'm sure that Salt Lake
that's
City,
where we'll go.
Yeah. And that will come to us. We won't always be this way. But right now, there's the marvelous thing about the Salt Lake food community is the sense of community, the sharing that everybody does, the willingness and excitement for everyone else to succeed as well, knowing that will strengthen your business.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. John is with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Hey, Doug. How's it going?
Great.
You know, I had a chance to go to the Taste of the Wasatch over the last few years up at Solitude, and I was blown away at how many, you know, newer restaurants are venturing out into things like you were talking about, using foods that you normally wouldn't think of. I moved here in 91, and I remember when the only microbrewery was Squatters, and the Coffee Garden was the only good cup of coffee I could get. So,
yeah, he raises that. John actually raises a question of where I wanted to go. The idea that it wasn't that long ago that things weren't so great around here in terms of food. I wanted you all to sort of mention this. I mean, what characterized the restaurants, you know, 15 years ago? I mean, because there were good ones. Should not say in any way that there weren't good restaurants here, but would be fair to say there weren't many of them. There weren't a lot of good ethnic restaurants, I think a lot of people would say. So what were we eating?
Oddly, I think some of the best restaurants when I moved here, which was, I don't remember how many years ago, were ethnic restaurants. Things like Maza was excellent by anyone's standards.
Red Iguana.
You know, the Mole, yeah, specifically at Red Iguana, was terrific. Takashi was terrific when he came along. And the rest of it was not very good. I mean, I started visiting here. I had already been a food writer for 15 years in other markets. And when I first started visiting here, I was like, where do I go eat? You could go to the Dodo. It's fine, you know, and there were some nice little breakfast kind of places, and there were some quaint places, but everybody's going to hate me, but I don't think there was any great food here for a long time, a very long time.
I moved here, I guess, maybe a year after.
Yeah, you're the old timer
here.
John,
I think it was. So I moved here in 92, started writing about food in 94. But, you know, back then, I actually, on the way here, jotted down a few. Straining my memory banks, and there was like Le Parisien, the Max Mercier's restaurant.
There was
the New Yorker was here.
Yeah,
you know, those were sort of the fine dining, the Heidelberg in Farmington. and for some of you old timers, these will ring some bells. And then, you know, the hot new place was, of course, the Barking Frog and Bocce Trattoria. You know, was sort of the first real
the gastronomy stuff.
Gastronomy restaurants. So, you know, you started to feel like you were eating in a sort of this cosmopolitan place with a place like Bocce, you know, and then a bunch of other places followed on the heels of those, and like Capital Cafe Absolute, Santa Fe, Cafe Bacchus, Bill and Nate, as we remember fondly.
Wow. Yeah.
But there wasn't a lot of fresh food. You couldn't get a piece of fresh fish. There was no sushi, you know, and there wasn't a lot in the way of, like, now I could name a dozen perfectly good Indian restaurants, two dozen Thai restaurants in this town.
Ethiopian
restaurants, African. And, you know, and there's just there are probably 30 places where you can get a good bowl of pho, you know,
yeah,
for Vietnamese
right.
soup. So, boy, we've come along a long way in the 20 years that I've been writing about food.
So what, Becky and Josh, what was the, and I want to ask you guys too, but what was the, what changed? I mean, this is the question. I think you've all kind of identified, like, 2009,
yeah,
something happened.
Yeah, I mean,
at least from this new perspective.
What's funny about this for me is that I've been here 13 years, almost 13 years, but I, with this sort of 2009-ish, like, that's my coming of age in some senses with food. So that's a lot of what I know.
Yeah.
And in that time, I've learned about their metropolitan and all these other places that were here before, but I've learned because of Pago and because of Evan Lewandowski, who's a winemaker. That's how I know anything about wine, or Jimmy Santangelo. So I think what happened in 2009, even though I don't necessarily think this restaurant is responsible for it, I think this restaurant was there at the right time, and it's Pago for me.
And this is Scott Evans.
Scott Evans' restaurant. So Pago over at 9th and 9th. And the reason that one was significant is because, for me personally, it was approachable. It's expensive, but it's approachable. And so I could go in there, and there were no white tablecloths. I could make the place a little bit messy. I had to pay a steep bill at the end, but people who were late 20s were going in there, sitting down, having an incredible experience with food. Afterward, you didn't have money to go to a movie, So food became your whole night. And so food took the place of dinner and a movie. It just became dinner because you couldn't afford something else possibly. And also these dinners take longer than Olive Garden or growing up in the restaurants that I grew up in West Texas. You didn't want to stay there that long. But with a place like Pago, it's a longer service. And it was just easier for someone with my income to go in there. Maybe it's once every 6 months. Maybe it's once a year. But to sit there and just love
and have a good meal.
Yes.
So Scott was providing something that was good. The quality was good. But it also seemed accessible in a different way?
To me, completely accessible because it had some really it had some elements of what I've loved about food to that point to where I could eat it and just like it and not have to think about it, as silly as that sounds. Some food when I got into sushi through Mikado here, I had to think about it a lot. And coming from West Texas, it was a weird thing to get into sushi. But with what I was getting at Pago on the plate was something I could eat and just love it and not have to think about it or not have to get past something in my mind to be able to just enjoy it.
What do you guys think? 2009-ish, are you identifying that as a significant time as well? And
yeah,
Scott, Evans, and Pago.
Josh touched on something that I guess, you know, I'm looking at maybe a little bit wider time frame. And I really think that you mentioned the Metropolitan. Karen Olson, when she and her brother opened the Metropolitan, Christoph Olson, that was a game changer.
Right?
Yeah, it was on Third South. And that was a game changer. That was really elevated the stakes and raised the stakes for fine dining. And I mean, they were doing stuff nobody had ever seen before here. I mean, literally seen. The food looked like art and it was formidable. And there was a time I remember writing and I had moved here from New York City and I remember saying that I thought that Metropolitan was as good as any restaurant you'd find in New York City or San Francisco at its peak. And I don't know if there'd necessarily be a Forage or a Pago or, you know, some of these other restaurants without that pioneer, the Olsons, you know, those pioneers.
I agree. And a lot of that was because of Karen's and Christoph's wide travels. They had a lot of experience eating all over the world, brought ideas back, and there wasn't any place like it. It sort of stood alone for a long time. I think that the thing about Pago was not just that Pago happened, but concurrently, because this is when I first was writing for the magazine. I guess I'd been writing for the Tribune before that. Forage opened up about the same time, and it didn't have the local thrust or was a little more challenging. But
you're knocked out.
I was knocked out.
Yeah, I was knocked out.
Because it was so adventurous. It was so adventurous. And I thought, how are Utahns going to respond to this? You know, I mean, they had always judged restaurants by how much food they got, as if there was like a scale on the table. Look, I got 8 pounds of food. And they kept my water glass full.
You know? Right.
So, you know, but how are they going to react to this?
Well, what do you make of that? I mean, you include Bowman Brown and Viet Tham, who were, they started that. Bowman's, of course, still there. And they're still in business. I mean, people are still going. Right?
That restaurant messes with me just because it's so interesting. It's so unique. And I can't go. So, for example, I could go, and you guys could totally disagree with me on this. I could go to Pago or I could go to Copper Onion. Not that they're doing the same thing, but there's going to be some similar elements, similar things with the experience that I could pick between the two. And I'm going to be happy either way. With Forage, it's either Forage or nothing. And there's one that's even in that
way
ballpark.
Way outside your comfort zone.
Yeah.
That's what's so unusual about it. That's why it's so surprising.
Well,
it's like
Bowman Brown he's like Red Zepi, right? Like the famous terrific chef for Noma.
Right.
Who goes out and forages and it's about.
Well, a lot of people forage. Dave Jones up at Log.
Sure. No,
Haven is a terrific forager and stuff, but he still stays in your like food is a comfort thing. And Bowman is out there as food is an art, and you're going to think a whole different way about it. It's the difference between an impressionist landscape now and and some kind of performance art. You go, what is this?
He could make you want to eat belly button lint. I mean, you know.
No, I know. know.
I think a lot of these chefs have brought their experiences back to Utah. Some of them maybe were born and raised here. Ted and I were talking about this earlier. But then they go out and they have these experiences in other countries or by moving just to other large cities in America. And then they see how – they remember how great Utah is, come back, but bring those experiences with them. Also, people like Romina at Le Madeleine, she's traveled a lot. She takes time off, I think, once a year and goes and has experiences where she brings back these ideas to her little bakery. And I feel like a lot of the chefs here are doing that. They're going and having some cultural experiences where they can come and bring that inspiration back with them.
How important is Steven Rosenberg to the local food scene? This is something you call him one of these pioneers.
He's one of the pioneers.
Yeah, I call him, in my opinion, again, remember, I'm coming of age in 2009, so these guys have seniority on me. In my opinion, he laid the groundwork and took a lot of risks that other grocers, other providers enjoy the groundwork that he laid. So the sort of the way
I should point out
sourcing.
That Steven Rosenberg is owner, of course, of Liberty Heights Fresh.
Yeah.
For people who don't, I want to make this sound like an inside job. I don't know people who don't know who he might be, but yeah, he was.
Yeah,
he's selling local before
that
cool
was even
to
a thing,
eat
you know?
Local. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
He's very,
and,
very
and
committed.
He's passionate and he's evangelistic.
Yeah.
I think we've called him that in the magazine, you know, food evangelist. Mm-hmm. But that little store had a tremendous influence and was, I remember when I discovered it here because I spent a long time writing for gourmet grocery stores and doing their marketing and copy and stuff in other places. And his cheese selection and his awareness of cheeses and his influence on the whole American Cheese Society is tremendous. And, I don't think Matt Caputo is fantastic, but he could not have done what he's done without Steve Rosenberg blazing the way.
Yeah, and I think people all around the country and even probably some around the world would identify Steven as pretty influential in the various worlds of specialty foods,
right?
Cheese and all.
So.
Ryan Lauder of Copper Onion, he's an important one, I think, for you, Becky and Josh. Here's what you put it in the book. You say, thanks to Copper Onion, Utah believes in itself. So that's I think you're seeing it as a very important restaurant for this place.
I think it's
place.
A restaurant people here are proud of. You know, when you have a visitor in town, you probably want to take them to Copper Onion, go get their famous burger or try something maybe that guest hasn't tried before, like we were talking about the bone marrow or something interesting that we know is going to be good, but it's going to put someone out of their comfort zone a little bit. So, yeah, it's something as Utahns that we're proud of. And Ryan's one of those chefs who has gone outside. He's, I think, born and raised in Utah.
Idaho. He's Idaho.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But close
in
by.
In and out west.
Yeah. And then he's, you know, gone and had these experiences and then brought that richness of his experiences back with him.
And I think what's unique about Copper Onion is that it made it to the suburbs of Salt Lake. So if an urban center is what influences the suburbs and then the suburbs respond to what's happening in the urban core, I think I saw Copper Onion. It was the first one that made it to people in Draper talking about the Copper Onion and wanting to come downtown. And so his restaurant, he has a lot of seats, and they are always packed, and there's always a long wait. And I think that people, if you talk to anyone outside of the urban core of Salt Lake and you talk about a restaurant that's downtown, they're very proud of the Copper Onion.
Let's take a break. We're not going to get to every restaurant in Salt Lake City, by the way, folks. And I'm sure we're actually hoping that this is a jumping off point for a series of conversations about local food. I want to get to talk more about other restaurants, other people who are doing interesting things, but also the sort of non-restaurant businesses. Because you mentioned these a lot in your book, too. Talk about what that tells us about Utah's food scene. We have with us Josh Rosenthal. He and his wife, Becky, run the blogs SLC Foodie and Vintage Mixer. We're talking about their new book, which is called Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. Mary Brown Maloof is with us, longtime food writer, the editor of Salt Lake Magazine. And we have Ted Scheffler back with us, who food writer and wine reviewer for Salt Lake City Weekly, co-editor of the new local food magazine, Devour. So we'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah's, well, Salt Lake in particular, well, Utah, their food scene. We have with us Josh and Becky Rosenthal, who've written a new book that explores the food scene, Salt Lake City's food scene. It's called Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. We also have food writers Mary Brown Maloof and Ted Scheffler with us. So let's go outside of restaurants for a bit and talk about some of the businesses that you write about. One in particular, I think these guys are great. Amour Spreads. This is, of course, John and Casey Francis. I know them because they go out and pick choke cherries and make choke cherry jam. And what I love about that is my mom did the same thing, still does the same thing. And so I've actually told them, I said, I know where you guys can get choke cherries. But so talk a little bit about them, because they're terrific.
They were the first people to babysit our child. So if that says anything about how we feel about them. So they are the sweetest. You don't even have to like jam, and you want to buy their entire inventory because you love them. If you interact with them, you will love them. That's at least my experience.
Yeah, and I feel like that their passion for what they do comes out in not only the flavor of their jam, but in the way that they do business too. That they're always supporting other people and just very encouraging. But I love their story of how, you know, they just were hiking and happened upon this field of berries and picked them, and then they went home and made their first batch, and they said, let's do more of this, and kind of fell in love with the whole idea of making jam in kind of an old-fashioned, old-school way.
And then they launched their product out of Pago. Pago launched the product for them, and then Steven Rosenberg championed it probably first to the masses.
Yeah, I concur. They're an amazing couple, and I love their products. I mean, and every time I see John, he sort of hands me a jar of something new that he's just found. You know, I find these berries that I didn't know existed.
I know.
And not only that, but he's also a world-class fiddler.
Oh, my goodness,
so
yes.
He is. He's
He's won the international championship. Yeah.
Well, there's Amour Spreads. There's Laziz, too. You read about them.
And they're kind of paving the way in a lot of different things in Utah, which is exciting just to follow.
Explain
them
who they are. This is Moody Sabaiti and Derek Kitchen, of course.
Yeah, so they're kind of the leading couple in
marriage equality.
Yeah,
marriage equality for the state. So.
Yeah, and
Kitchen versus Herbert. That's
Derek Kitchen. Yeah. And what a convenient last name for what he does. so likable. They're painfully likable. Like, that's just what's so interesting is that sometimes I wonder, does their food actually taste good? Because I just like them and I want to buy.
Am I fooled by how charming they are? Yeah.
But no, their stuff is incredible, and it's very simple, and it's not processed, and it's delicious. I mean, they do hummus, muhamra, and toum with more to come. Moody is from Lebanon, and so he'll do more Lebanese-inspired things like this, and they'll do a cafe in the next year.
Yeah, they're
so
dreaming
as well.
Of the deli cafe, which I can't wait.
Yeah,
Maloof.
Yeah.
But they will spoil you. Like, you taste their hummus, and you go outside of their product, and you taste hummus other places, and
theirs is the real deal.
Yeah, it's smooth and creamy.
If their hummus is what hummus is supposed to taste like, then I have never tasted hummus before.
right.
No, I know. You taste the chickpea peanut butter or whatever
Cristiano Criminelli.
It's just exciting. He's everywhere. He's all over the country, and we get to meet him and know him and have him here in Salt Lake. It's so great.
Another likable guy, too.
Yeah. An extraordinary story. What I think interesting about Cristiano is also that he went, if I understand the story right, he went looking for the right place, just the right conditions for his salami, which are world-class.
Yeah.
And the right pigs.
Yeah, I remember interviewing the first time. He said, it's all about the piga. I've always teased him about
that. Well, and this was the place where he found it, which that's remarkable.
I mean, he's a 14th generation salami maker.
Yeah. Right.
And he left, was it Alto Adige? No, he was northwest, Piedmont.
Piedmont.
14th generation left, came to America after meeting, I believe, someone at the Olympics that was going to help him think through this. I'm really botching that. But he comes and settles in Utah. And just blows everyone's mind.
Well, it had to change the FDA's mind. That's not hard. It was like the people who pioneered Iberico's import.
Yeah.
You know, you had to convince the whole FDA that it was okay to cure sausage this way.
Yeah, he housed
just
an
by
FDA.
Humidity. And, you know, I mean, that was a big, that's huge.
Yeah. And it was, this was all in Caputo's basement.
Right. I was going to say, he just like Chuck Leter Blue, you know, sort of emerged from Caputo's, which is really phenomenal when you think about it, you know. I mean, because this is world-class, these are world-class provisions we're talking about.
Well, the same with Amano and
Solstice now.
And so that's part of what we're talking about, is that fostering kind of the established food businesses. Foster these younger ones and bring them along. It's great. I mean, you experienced that with Charming Beard.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned No Brow Coffee Works. It's funny. John mentioned earlier, the caller, that you couldn't really get a good cup of coffee. Not very many places. Yeah. Now it's not hard to find a good cup of coffee.
John Piquet at Cafe de Bola is like, he's a coffee savant.
He
really is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is called on nationally, you know, with places like, what's the place out of Chicago? I can't remember the name right now. Anyway, that pipes in its own water and stuff like that. He's amazing as far as artisanally brewed coffee goes.
Yeah, we've got that. And with No Brow, that one, they've undergone some changes of late, but they're still making really great coffee. Phenomenal espresso. Their drinks are incredible. And the Rose establishment also. I think the Rose and No Brow, though No Brow was around earlier by some 3 or 4 years, maybe more. The Rose was another one that pushed really great coffee into the masses, I guess.
But again, just like you were talking about your coffee being at the new Finca, the new downtown location, one of the things that makes Cremonelli and Beehive Cheese and Amore, all these places possible, are the restaurateurs who help promote and use their products.
And buy it.
That's a really cool thing. I mean, you know, going back to Ali Sabah, Maza, and, you know, there's always been sort of a culture here of, you know, if you make it, we'll use it, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's a real sort of ecosystem here, a sort of foodie ecosystem.
Right. Yeah. It's mutually supportive. They're not looking to outdo someone by flying in the most obscure, expensive thing. They'd rather buy it from someone in the community and tout that. And you see it all over the menus. Yeah. It's not like that everywhere, even in places that are touting local.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as strong as it is here. Like I say, I think it's because it delves into a real deep core of Utah.
Because people are pickling beets, and they have been for a while.
For a long time, we've been pickling. Yeah. We've been, you know, that's exactly what I mean. And so, you know, I'll trade you some of my pickles for your jam, you know, or whatever. It's pioneering kind of stick togetherness that.
And I think
is
we're
unusual.
Just really lucky that we have this mentality of wanting to support, and there's this generation of producers that are doing world class stuff. So. To combine those together, I think we have something that's really sustainable that's happening.
It needs to be good quality. I know we've talked with Matt Caputo before, who, yes, he's all about supporting local, but he says, you know, it has to be good. We want the best.
Right.
Because there's some local stuff out there that we'll probably not mention.
That's right. Sure. The one thing I would say, or in a way, this localness has affected the wine scene. We have now a number of distillers. We've got a number of great brewers, but I think our wine scene lags still. We've got great personalities in our wine scene, but because of the state-run stores, you don't find someone expressing a particular passion in their retail inventory the way you do in other cities. Like, even in Boise, there's that little store that only carries wines from the Iberian Peninsula because of the Basque influence. And you can't do that here. You can't get obscure very much because of the way the state runs their business.
Well, you guys write about that. I mean, you write about the spirits scene, I guess, as well.
I guess we see hope in that area with people like Evan Lewandowski and with a lot of the
Church and State guys.
Yeah.
Church and State spirits, guys, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but you're only going to get so far with locally produced wine, like Evans.
Yeah.
We're not ever going to be a powerhouse like other places. I'd like to see someone who could delve into imported wines the way that we have with cheeses and other products and bring more in.
You mentioned Bar X, too. Mm-hmm. Duncan Burrell, Richard Noel, Jeff Barnard. What's interesting about that is I think you talk about the fact that it seems like people are willing to go and pay for a cocktail now, which might have one that's really high end.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, those It's a lot of money to go spend $10 to $14 on a cocktail. And again, I think it's another symptom of the dinner and a movie concept for an evening out going away and it being about whatever you're going to go eat or drink. And I feel like Bar X was one of those things that when it came along, and I know it's silly and it makes me feel very podunk to say, but that Ty Burrell had his name on it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And that he, I don't know if you ever read his sort of...
his love letter to Salt Lake City?
Yeah.
And I actually was thinking of writing into the show, talking a little bit about that, because he's talked a lot about Utah's food scene.
Yeah. He's proud of it. And then that makes us more proud of it, that someone like Ty Burrell, who could very easily live in L.A., live in New York, he could afford that, chooses to be here, and then is proud of what's happening here. I think that's another thing that adds to everyone's pride.
He evangelizes for local stuff, too, I think.
Yeah.
If you ever talk to
he's
him.
He's at Caputo's all the time, it seems, when he's in town.
Yeah, we've seen him at the farmer's market just doing the local shopping like we would do.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Wait, you know what? We need to take a break. Sorry. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Josh and Becky Rosenthal are with us. They are the husband and wife team that run the blog SLC Foodie and Vintage Mixer. Also, SLC Mixers. Do you do three blogs?
SLC Mixers was just the events that we would
do. That was a season of life.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Anyway, they're pretty busy. Their new book is called Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. Mary Brown Maloof is with us, longtime food writer and editor of Salt Lake Magazine. Ted Scheffler with us, the food and wine reviewer for Salt Lake City Weekly and co-editor of the new local food magazine, Devour. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah, Salt Lake City's food scene. Josh and Becky Rosenthal are with us. We're talking about their book called Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. Mary Brown Maloof and Ted Scheffler are also with us. So one of the things, Ted Scheffler, you said to us, I wanted to talk a little bit about, there is, of course, the question of ethnic food in Utah. You've talked about how the LDS culture in many ways has contributed to that there's a more openness now to ethnic food because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that you've got missionaries, you know, going out and spanning the globe and, you know, maybe you agree or disagree with their mission, but the fact is that they're exposed to all these different cultures and cuisines and they bring that knowledge back with them in many cases. I can't tell you how many times I've met small mom and pop restaurateurs and, you know, one the Japanese woman is married to a missionary or and, you know, there's these palates. There are a lot of Brazilian restaurants here that I don't think would even be here if not for the LDS presence in Brazil. And so, you know, an LDS young man comes back or woman and all of a sudden they want those flavors. They want that churrasco from Brazil or whatever, you know. And so I actually think that's it helps benefit the sort of wide range of different cuisines we have here.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let me take a call from Gina, who's with us in Salt Lake. Gina, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So, thinking beyond the restaurant scene and thinking more about the local food movement, how do we democratize that food movement? I work with sort of nutrition programs, and, you know, we're always talking about how we make local food more affordable and more accessible for everybody.
It's a terrible phone line, but we get the point. Did you guys hear that? I mean,
yes.
How do you democratize local food? How do you make it? Yes, it's one thing to be able to afford artisan salami, but not everyone can. So how do you sort of spread the love, I guess, is what she's getting at. That's the question, I guess.
It's the huge question. Food politics has become a bigger and bigger issue, especially as the wealth disparity has increased in this country, so that whereas a lot of us are feeding the temple of our body with exquisitely grown organic food, other people live in food deserts and get all their groceries from a fast food stores, so because that's what they can afford. And one thing I think that could be done is the Alice Waters idea of food in schools and growing your own food. That is the best way to do it. My sister is the chef for a school district in Texas, and they've made food part of the curriculum there. She goes in and she teaches them about food and growing food and what it's about, and gets them to taste all kinds of things they would have never tasted before as part of their learning, because they're not learning it at home. And right. I think that that's the kind of thing that, unfortunately, that's a...
And we do have a first lady who's made some of that her mission, right. with a certain amount of, you know, she's got a lot of flack for it.
Yeah. Right. That's going to be slower to come in Utah, right. because of the political bent.
There are a few schools I know doing things like that, like right. Glendale.
Right.
I think in Rose Park, they have a community kitchen that I got to come into one day, and they were teaching the kids how to cook with seasonal fresh vegetables and different things to do with them, and right. it was fun to see the kid what they liked and what they didn't like. And
well, Krista Paulson, like who's a teacher and was also head of Slow Food for a long time, the chapter here, worked with Harmon's to bring that program into a lot of schoolrooms. I wrote an article about that a couple years ago, but I think we could use a lot more of that.
Going back to ethnic restaurants, Saffron Valley, you have what tikka masala is the recipe you have in the which I should mention, by the way, for all the restaurants that you write about in the businesses, there are recipes. I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that. So was that hard to get recipes from some of these people?
You know what? For the most part, people were pretty generous with their recipes, because we asked for a lot of their best recipes.
Yeah, like the iconic ones.
Yeah, iconic ones, the ones that people keep coming back to their restaurants for. And I would say they were really generous with us. And I think that that's just that idea of abundance versus scarcity, that they believe, like we do, that this recipe will get more people in their doors instead of, you know, yes, you might try the tikka masala at home once or twice, but you taste it at home and you probably just want to go and taste it there too to compare the two. So yeah, I think people believed in our project, which we were really excited about. But Saffron Valley specifically, what she is doing for the food scene, she kind of started as a woman in business helping other women start businesses, and then she ended up starting a spice line, and then that developed into two restaurants, one in Sandy and one in the Avenues in downtown Salt Lake. And it's exciting to see what kind of Indian food she's bringing to Salt Lake, because her chef is from, like herself, they're from northern India. So
like
they're bringing
dosas.
Yeah, they're bringing some different things. So that's why we included the dosas in the book, to show that just kind of their spin on Indian food.
The she you're talking about is Lavanya.
Lavanya. Yes.
Mahate.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Lavanya.
I think that whole approach to Indian food, which used to be like one Indian food, that you kind of went in India, any restaurant here, and it was kind of all the same. Same with Thai food, and that we're getting a lot more differentiation in cuisines. I mean, you can't really talk about Indian food. You know, it's a continent, basically.
Right.
And it's kind of provincial to talk about Indian food, right? The same way we talk about Mexican food.
Yeah.
And it's one change. We do our dining awards every year and have for, I don't know how many years, Ted, you know better than I, probably 20 years. Yeah. And so every year I reflect heavily on the whole scene in Utah. This year I decided to throw out all the categories we've always used, you know, best Chinese, best, because it sounds provincial, and it's just 25 best restaurants, period. I don't care what they are, because you can't make all those little pigeonholes for everything.
Oh my, you want to say something about Oh My?
It's just really good. And it's like $6.
Right.
You know, it's really, that's
it. Oh My is a little Vietnamese shop. They serve banh mi sandwiches, and they're on State Street. I think they open up a new store as well. They were so popular. They might have two or three now. But a great place for banh mi, traditional Vietnamese sandwiches that are taken from the French influence on Vietnam with the baguette white bread. And they're delicious.
Amazing.
Get the sardine one, even though that may not be your normal sensibility.
Try it.
So good. Yeah.
So we're not going to get to all of these food trucks you write about. Of course, Chow Truck, which I think has been been remarkably influential. Maybe we'll do a show about food carts and food trucks, because you have that. And, of course, you go outside of Salt Lake. I mentioned Hell's Backbone. Absolutely. Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle there.
No story of Utah food is complete without.
It's really not.
No, and if you say, I mean, even before Pago, they were doing remarkable food.
Duck
a post down there in the wilderness and said, we're going to do this thing. Yeah. And they did it. That was the first story I wrote about in Utah food. And I was like, wow.
We asked the editor if we could go. We said, this just doesn't make sense to us if this restaurant is in there. And it really wasn't until the last minute. They were our last restaurant to do because we couldn't, you know, make it happen. But we finally did. Thank goodness.
But they were, I mean, talking about pioneers. Yeah. They, along with Black Sheep and what they're doing in Provo, they're more, you know, pioneers helping the food scene to take risks now.
Provo, the Black Sheep Cafe and Communal, you mentioned. Is Provo's scene blowing up?
I definitely think so. Anytime that we've had food there in the last 3 to 4 years even, we've been pleased. There are some restaurants that are in Provo that I wish were here in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Communal and Pizzeria 712 and Black Sheep are all just, they could be downtown Salt Lake or they could be in an urban spot and do well. They're just very good.
We're out of time, so I wanted to ask you all to sort of give me a sense of, I mean, one thing that Joshua and Becky mentioned in the book is that not that we've arrived yet, but we're headed there. There's a kind of a groundswell. Where are we headed? I mean, it sounds like you're all fairly optimistic about where we're headed.
I am. I mean, I work on a number of national sort of committees about food and so forth. And Utah is now a player where it was a joke before. So, I mean, we've gotten James Beard nominations, you know, over the last few years. That would never have happened before. We've got, we still need to work together to become a destination, a food destination where people will come here for that. And I think that that's a job for all of us to do, get out our pom-poms.
And, you know, I scratch my head and think 20 years ago, what was I writing about? What restaurants was I reviewing? You know, because it wasn't a barren landscape, but it was pretty lightly populated. And now all I can say is I have job security because all I need is Ryan Lauder and Scott Evans on the scene, and there's always going to be a new restaurant to write about.
Becky, what do you think?
Yeah, I think of people like Evan Lewandowski, who's hoping to plant a vineyard and make his own wine here, and, you know, care about the soil and the land here. So I'm hopeful for where we're going and more good food and drink being grown here in Utah.
And I think Utah, my hope is that eventually Salt Lake will be known for being Salt Lake, not a version of Portland, not a version of San Francisco. And that's my hope for this city. And I think that's where we're going. And it's just a matter of time.
It's Josh Rosenthal. He and his wife, Becky, are the co-authors of the book Salt Lake City Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Crossroads of the West. They're going to be at the King's English Bookshop tonight at 7. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Thanks very much, you two.
Thank you.
Ted Scheffler, thanks.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And Mary Brown Maloof,
thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.